This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or tieke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family. A family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the tieke from total extinction.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.nz.
Good morning, friends. We are fortunate to have Victor Billo, the leader of the Alliance Party and an Alliance candidate for Dunedin. And he's also communications officer for the Maritime Union. Good morning, Victor. How are you?
Hi, good, thank you.
How do you like doing two jobs at once?
Yes, it's proving to be quite a challenge, but it's just, one step and then the next step and you just keep going. So we're handling it at the moment.
Were you quite pleased when you reached 500?
Well, yeah, that was our goal, to get 500 members. And the reason for that figure, for people who aren't aware of the ins and outs of it, to be a registered political party in New Zealand, you have to have 500 members and complete a bit of paperwork for that. And that allows you to run a party list. That's the main benefit of that. But it also gives you probably some credibility, and you get mentioned in polls and things. So anyway, we got to the 500.
When you get that?
Yes, although that's a bit of a complicated issue. You get a bit more media pickup if you're a registered party. We've applied for registration. We've got the members, but we're still waiting for the final approval. But yes, it's an interesting thing, the media coverage, because we didn't apply earlier for electoral funding. You can get some money from the Electoral Commission for advertising if you're a registered party, but that's been a bit of a problem for us because we weren't registered at the time when that closed off, so we aren't getting that at the moment, but we're going to have a little bit of a do a bit of work on that to see if we can change their minds on it. I don't know if we will.
Okay. Tell us about the Alliance Party, because not everybody, younger people, wouldn't be familiar with it. And what is the Alliance Party, and what led you to promote a resurrection of the Alliance Party?
Yeah, well, the resurrection, that's a good term. It's a nicer one. Some people might think it's like bringing back Frankenstein's monster or something. But no, look, the Alliance was a political party that existed in the past in a much more higher profile kind of way. It was formed in the early 90s as basically a grouping of left-leaning parties in New Zealand, including the New Labour Party, Jim Anderton, the Green Party and some others. And it came out of basically a lot of concerns at what had happened in the 1980s with the very right-wing Labour Party government. It caused a lot of problems there with their right-wing policies. They've never really walked back on a lot of them. And then the National got in the 90s, and that was a very extreme right-wing kind of policies, kind of like what we're seeing now. At that time, there was very high unemployment and all sorts of social problems. So the Alliance was a kind of reaction to that.
We're seeing a replay of some of that. I mean, it seems to me like we've got more people homeless than ever. The food banks are can't keep up with the people that need the food.
Well, I don't think any of that ever went away. I mean, it became a feature of New Zealand society in the 80s and 90s, and obviously...
It certainly wasn't in the 70s.
No, no, that's quite right. It was not a feature of New Zealand society in the post-war era, right up to the 1970s. It was, you know, New Zealand certainly had its problems, but they weren't among them in terms of economic security for the majority of people. So I think what we are going into now is we are... we've had all those problems. They have never gone away from the 1980s, 1990s.
Could they go away if you have an economic system that's based on neoliberalism, on free market entirely taking control of everything?
Well, that's what was sold in the 80s and 90s. That was the argument that was sold by the right wing in New Zealand, that if we had these certain type of economic policies, their type of ideas, which were based around kind of look after number one, individual greed, individual selfishness. That basically was underpinning it. They used different words, but that's what it means. And an economy where the state had very little role to play except basically to jail people and to, enforce capitalism, basically, free market capitalism. So as a result, you got a lot of, and everything was the free market would look after things. Well, I mean, society still exists today. We're still rumbling along. Some people are doing very well, but I don't think anyone could really honestly say that the promise of a prosperity for all and a really a wonderful place, that hasn't come true. And in fact, for a lot of people now, life has become a never-ending struggle in economic terms, let alone psychological terms or health terms. And that's what we want to do something about. That's why the Alliance exists.
So you think we need economic and social change?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been thinking that for probably my entire adult life, because I reached adulthood at a time when we were moving between the two systems that New Zealand had. We had the kind of post-war system, which was quite a regulated economy.
More like Northern Europe, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean
it wasn't regulated. It wasn't anywhere near a communist society or a really regulated society. I mean, there's plenty of freedom as far as I could tell, but you had a social network that was very much like Denmark's or Finland's or Norway's or Germany's even.
Yeah, well, I think that was came out of the 1930s in New Zealand, the first Labor government, a genuine Labor government, as opposed to the kind of pretenders we have these days, was a government that actually made huge, massive changes to the way things were done that were regarded as radical, but had the support of most people because by the time they were elected in 1935, New Zealand had been in the grip of a global depression, economic depression, and there was a tremendous amount of suffering and poverty. And their policies contributed, no doubt, to the relief of that. And as a result, even Conservative National Party governments right up to the 70s and 80s didn't dare to mess with the basics of that plan. So we've gone for another 30 or 40 years now. We've gone back to the kind of policies they had maybe in the 19th century. We have a kind of very free market-based economy, very unequal society, and I think it's coming up to the time now where we're in a global crisis, we're in a national crisis, and I think people are looking for a change, and I think that's why the Alliance has come back at this time, because it is needed and people are ready for the message.
What does the Alliance offer New Zealand that Labor doesn't?
Well, I think the way I see it is that the Alliance has a common origin with the Labor Party. The Alliance came out of the Labor Party in terms of it was formed by the Jim Anderton, the new Labor Party. And my argument is that the Alliance is actually the genuine descendant of the original principles and policies of the Labor Party. What's happened to the Labor Party itself, obviously it's the main opposition party, it's a lot bigger than us, but like Labor parties all around the world, they have become completely compromised and co-opted by the system that they set out to change nearly 100 years ago. So I see ourselves as quite a different to the Labor Party. Obviously, we will work with the Labor Party. We have to try and get rid of the current coalition government. That's a priority. But certainly we're promoting different style of policies. We're a democratic socialist party in actual fact as opposed to just words. And that means pushing some quite strong policies around equality, around access to public services, around removing just this complete dependence on the market as solving all our economic issues.
Actually, the government doesn't always leave everything to the market. I think landlords have done quite well recently.
Well, I think that's the housing's a good one to kind of touch on, and it's got another side effect too because of the tax issue. Now, we've had National and Labor governments in this country for forever, you know, and the National government in the last 30 or 40 years, its mission has been to what's driving it is its purpose and its meaning is based around ensuring profit for the people who own New Zealand, who are largely now more and more overseas corporations and so forth, but also the local kind of ruling elite, I guess you could call them, and landlords and you know, I'm talking about big scale people, owners of property and capital. And they've done very well out of national governments. So I don't think anyone...
They got a big tax break this year.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think what's happened now, though, is that the particular national government is backed by the ACT Party, which, of course, is very, very right-wing, and the New Zealand First Party, which is, I don't know how right-wing it is. I think it's more opportunistic than anything. They just... Winston just says things that he knows will get him 5 to 10% of the vote, and he doesn't really care what effect they have. So I think that we're facing a very bad situation with the current government. The current policies are obviously causing a lot of harm. Everyone knows it, but they're also helping some people, and those people just happen to be the people who already have a lot of wealth and power in this country. So we see that where that's going. The problem is with the Labor opposition is they don't really seem to be kind of have the backbone, the analysis, the policies, the motivation to really challenge that at a really basic level. They kind of seem to be want to tweak things. And really avoiding the hard questions that we're not living in a system that is delivering for the working class majority, if I could use that a term that seems to have dropped out of fashion in the last few years.
As old as I am, I wasn't around when I'm going to talk about. But the first Labor government, many of the people who retired into state houses. Being in a state house wasn't considered you weren't a pharaoh or you weren't subjected to blame or insults for living in a state house. It wasn't called social houses, it was called state houses, and many Labor members of Parliament retired into state houses. And I suspect you had very few Labor members of Parliament who had two or three houses plus the one they lived in.
Yeah, well, I think what's happened is...
I mean, are you going to vote for a really effective capital gains tax if you've got number of members who...
Yeah. Well, the capital gains tax is a funny one. Certainly, the Alliance stands for tax reform, and the reason we want to do that is not just for the sake of it. I mean, you know, tax is an imposition. You know, you have to pay money out of your wages or whatever, but we are very clear that without tax, you don't get a basic civilised society. It pays for things we all collectively use, such as healthcare, education, infrastructure, the very things that, you know, hold our society together, and without which business would not be able to function. Let's be completely clear about that.
Doesn't the capital gains tax actually encourage people to land bank property and houses? And doesn't it actually promote a scarcity of housing?
Well, the capital gains,
people can afford to rent.
The problem is with the capital gains tax, or we completely support it, because on the basis that we are in favour of taxing wealth, not work.
But if you don't have it, don't you get a society where few people own most of the houses?
Well, I think that's we've seen New Zealand's one of the few countries in the world that doesn't have a capital gains tax. I mean, we should be perfectly clear here that a capital gains tax is, for those people who don't know, it's a tax that is put on capital gains. Like, for example, if you have a house or a business that accrues in value over time, and you are taxed on that increase in value. How that happens, it depends on the particular type of capital gains tax and how you achieve it. But basically, the importance of something like this, it was very important, and if it had been brought in 15 years ago or 20 years ago, it would have served a very good purpose, and that would have generated a lot of money because of the out-of-control property market, but it would have also probably reduced the level to which the property market got out of control. And that has led to a very serious problem in New Zealand society around housing, because basically we permitted the greed of a generation, of a wealthy part of a generation, to prevail over the needs of society and everyone. And as a result, housing, the purpose of housing became as a get-rich-quick scheme for people to invest in, as opposed to providing a secure home for families and people to lead their lives, productive lives in. So that's why we've got a problem.
One of the assets you could own without being taxed on it.
Yes, and all around the world,
and
there's capital gains
tax
taxes everywhere.
If you didn't have a strong capital gains tax.
Well, it's actually, you're quite right, and it's completely outrageous that nothing was done about it. But what annoys me about it is I can understand when people like Christopher Luxon kind of go, well, you know, they give themselves tax breaks, because that's what they're all about. They're about self-interest. They make it quite clear in their policies and what they say. At least their level of honesty there, they only care about themselves. They don't care about how ordinary people are doing. They see ordinary people as things to make money out of. Whereas what really annoys me, though, is the absolute hypocrisy of the Labor Party to bleat about it when you had two leaders of the Prime Ministers, Labor Prime Ministers, Jacinda Ardern, who was known for her kindness, apparently, and Chris Hipkins, who basically said, no, we're not doing capital gains taxes. We're not interested. No, it's no good. And they basically set that back by years and years and years and years and years when it could have made a difference. And now, while we bring it in, it's not going to make much of a difference because obviously the housing market's tanked and everyone's up to their neck in debt and a few people have done very well out of it, including Australian banks. And we have to say, well, that problem was in part caused by the failure of Labor Party leaders to stand up for what was in the interests of working class people and basically cave in to the wealthy and powerful. And I don't think that speaks very well about where they are and what they're doing at all.
Now, this is one of the things that I remember is that David Parker and a few others in the Labor Party proposed a strong capital gains tax, and the leadership of the Labor Party in the last Labor government said, no, not while we're leaders.
Well, I guess you could say there the postscript or the epilogue to that event was, where's David Parker now and where are the leaders of the Labor Party? The leaders of the Labor Party are still there. David Parker's long gone. His message was not wanted. And don't get me wrong, I mean, David Parker was by no means a particularly left-wing finance person, but he did see, obviously he saw that it was unsustainable, the kind of system we have was unsustainable, and we needed a way to stop the torrent of wealth that has been concentrated in a small section of our society, which has been drained from the working class majority. And he recognised it was a problem, like most economists do and most people of any kind of moral compass or historical understanding understand that's a problem. But the people in charge of our society now, they're not interested in problems. They're just interested in what's in it for them.
That's so the American model, isn't it?
Well, I think this is the thing. America's got undergone, always been more of a probably a capitalist nation than New Zealand has in some ways. But I think even in the past in America, you had far more. I mean, you had in the post-war period, you had unions, you had you had FDR and everything and the New Deal in the 30s. So even in America, they did go down that path a little bit. They had a very high tax rate in the United States.
But Thatcher and Reagan changed the direction.
Well, this is the thing.
They got elected to support neoliberalism and implement, and they did. And then the Democrats followed suit.
Yeah, well, and this is the thing. And unfortunately, like a lot of people now don't have the – if they don't – aren't aware of that history, and you're not taught about it really, so you have to kind of find out for yourself, is that, yes, in the last 40, 50 years, all Western societies have undergone a massive – change because of globalization, because of technological change, but also because of economic policies that were introduced, in my view, simply to ensure that the wealthy and powerful minority in our society, the upper class, if you want to call it that, grab that power back.
They've succeeded, haven't they?
Yes, totally. There's no doubt about it. Working class people now, considering we've gone for another 50 years, supposedly, of economic growth, we're living in a much more high-tech society, et cetera, all these things, you'd go, well, surely this is, if this is the case, why are basic public services doing worse? Why do we have high levels of unemployment and underemployment? Why do we have inequality? Why do we have working people? There were a lot of things wrong in the 60s and so forth, but incomes weren't one of them. I mean, a one-income family could have a modest, reasonable lifestyle. I'm not saying they were wealthy, but they could have a secure, could feed themselves, pay for their accommodation on one income. Working people can't do that in two incomes now. So we have a thing called working for families, which was a great innovation of the Labor Party once again, which it's good for people who, to pay, working people can pay for their bills if they get a working for families. But you have to ask, aren't we just subsidising employers to pay wages that aren't livable for their workforce?
Well, that's similar to the subsidy for housing.
Exactly.
The person who gets the subsidy doesn't benefit from it because the landlord takes it.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, and this is about a lot of the problems, is that these things that we think are helping, we go, oh, that's social welfare, you're helping people, and some people don't even like that because they don't like people being helped. They prefer people remain in poverty and misery. But a lot of the things that have happened to supposedly benefit the population have actually benefited the people who already have all the wealth and power and have more of it. And this isn't an opinion. This is a fact. You just need to look at the statistics. You need to look at, the trend of wealth concentration and the wealth distribution in society, the income distribution over the last 30 or 40 years, and it's going one way, straight up. And that's common in Australia. It's common in the UK, Europe, and the United States to varying degrees. It's a worldwide phenomenon, and we've got to reverse it.
Why have many working class become supporters of right-wing parties such as Marie Le Pen's right-wing National Rally Party in France or Donald Trump's Republican Party?
Well, I think that that's always been there to a degree. I mean,
It's increased.
Yeah, I think, and it has increased, and I think that's for two reasons. One, that I think that period in the post-war 60s and 70s, perhaps, where people had more economic security, that's gone. So people are now facing economic stress, ordinary people. That's one issue. So they're looking for someone to blame. Two, you have had much higher levels of immigration in societies, and now because of all global disruption and so forth and wars, you are getting refugees moving around. And it's not the refugees' fault, but this creates some stress on infrastructure. It creates a perception, usually wrong, that outsiders, as people think, are getting a better deal than the locals. And it is all used by a certain strata of politician to, what I say, it's divide and rule. It's divide the working class, because the working class, the majority, and it doesn't matter what skin colour you are, what your creed is, what even sometimes what your gender is or something, you have an interest in, common interest in getting the kind of things in society that look after you and people like you. Whereas if you look at the Farages, the Pauline Hansons, they see this as a great tool to play on prejudice and bigotry and division, to build a political career on that, and they get a lot of support because
if you can blame it on the immigrants, you don't have to deal with why there are homeless people. You don't have to deal with low wages. You just point to the immigrants.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, you know, that's
you need
what's
a good
happened.
Scapegoat.
Yeah, so there. I mean, and it's nothing new. I mean, it's like and people like Winston in New Zealand, they're not quite as evil, perhaps, as I just don't think he really believes in anything, to be honest. But they use it. He uses it, and you know, it was the Asian panic in the 1990s and so forth, and then we go back. There was the Pacific Islanders were to blame, and we had the Dawn raids in the 70s, and then it was the whinging Poms, as they called people who came out from England, and before that it was the Irish Catholics were the out group in New Zealand society, and before that it was the Chinese gold miners. So, and of course, New Zealand was founded on colonisation and violent invasion as well. So it's just been something there that's been there throughout history, and my view is quite blunt on that. It's basically a way that capitalism divides working people who have a common interest, which is, leading a decent life for themselves and their families. And if they get those things, I think a lot of this division and hatred would melt away.
Do you want one of the problems was the thanks to the changes that the Labour brought in the 80s, when the National Party became the government in the 90s, they were emboldened and brought in the Employment Contracts Act. And what effect did this have on unions?
Well, unions, of course, were at one stage, we had compulsory unions in New Zealand, which wasn't all that necessarily a perfect system. Certainly a lot of unions, I think, were very weren't particularly active or progressive organisations, but you had them, and they provided a very useful role for working people, in that they advocated for workers, they advocated for wage improvements and conditions and health and safety and all those things, which of course is much easier and more effective when you do it collectively. On your own, you're very easy to silence and so forth. But of course, you know, and we have the Chamber of Commerce, we have the Federated Farmers, of course, the people who own society, they have their own associations and they work collectively. But apparently workers aren't allowed to have unions. I don't know how that works, but it does. But yeah, unions have been smashed. I've been involved in unions for a long time. They are less effective than they've been. The membership is lower than it's ever been. And basically that we've been operating in a extremely hostile environment for a long time. And that was quite deliberate, because along with social housing.
Take out the words, Employment Contracts Act.
You're
not having, it's individual contracts where you're, in some cases, large multinationals, and you make your individual contract when you sign up to work, and that's supposed to be a fair deal.
Well, I guess, we've zoomed around over the decades. Before we had the Employment Contracts Act, you had a award system. You had a tripartite system where individual businesses didn't decide what wages were. What happened is that you had a meeting between the government, employers, and unions, and they'd decide what the wage increase for the country was going to be like. Of course, not everyone was happy with that. Sometimes unions wanted more, sometimes and thought it was holding them back. Sometimes employers were unhappy. But it was some kind of semi-organised kind of deal was made. Whereas now, of course,
and
it's, you know,
workers had some kind of representation through the unions.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't perfect, but it certainly they had more say and more representation than they now have when it comes to employment.
Well, the old saying is, it's like, you know, the only way that the working class have ever got anywhere is a group, is organise, organise, organise. And that means organising in unions, and it means working together collectively to negotiate, improve your conditions, improve your lot in wider society. As individuals, we are, unless individuals have a lot of wealth and power, and a few of them do, not many, then you're very isolated. And that's where the power of unions comes from.
Do you think if people were organized collectively and working for change and have some hope for that change, you think they're less likely to need scapegoats like immigrants or like the Chinese or the Pacific Islanders, whoever they, the powers that be decide to point to? Do you think there's less, you think people are less accessible to that kind of prejudice if they're actually in an organization that's trying to change things for the better?
Yeah, and I think that's what's happened with the breakdown in unions. I'm not saying that unions were, there are plenty of union members in the past, and there's probably a few now who have terrible views. I mean, it's not about being a, it's not a kind of individual kind of like who's nice people or not. It's just a fact of organising. But I think what's happened is you have breakdown in those community organisations and unions and mass political parties and ability for people to feel they have some kind of control over their lives. So that insecurity, that fear, and, you know, there's always been racism in New Zealand, there's no doubt about this. That's nothing, that's no news. That it can get manipulated and focused and in a really sinister way. And I think if we had, you know, if we had a more equal society where people weren't under such stress and where there were better unions, there was more political consciousness and awareness, I think a lot of these problems would, they wouldn't go away, but they wouldn't be at the terrible level they are now.
Do you think that one of the reasons for the Move On legislation is to actually create the image of homeless people not as victims of the landlords and the working and the upper class, but as troublemakers, as people that you don't have to take seriously?
Well, I think you could have both things happen at the same time. I mean, and you have to look at a solution. There's no doubt about it that a lot of homeless people have major life problems as well as homelessness. I mean, it's all contributed. They often have mental health issues. Not all of them, but a lot of the people, the rough sleepers, do have mental health issues, have drug problems, have all sorts of issues, which often make them difficult to deal with and can make them antisocial. But the answer to that is not to just try to kind of kick them along the street a bit, which is the National Party's answer. It's to go, okay, well, they came from somewhere. This problem came from somewhere. It didn't just, we didn't have this problem in the 1960s and 1970s. And people of your generation and my dad's generation, the idea of people begging in the streets in our cities in Dunedin, living rough in the streets in our cities in Dunedin, that would have just been unbelievable. It would have just been just quite a bizarre, you know, what's happened? Have we had a, you know, major cataclysm of our society? No. Well, we have had a major cataclysm of our society. It's called right-wing neoliberal capitalist policies, and they've had a terrible effect on vulnerable people. So I think that the National Party has a motive there. They realise that their policies generate unemployed people. They realise they generate homeless people. They realise they generate people with problems and probably leads to criminal behaviour. So their task is to kind of blame the people who end up in those situations. It's therefore
under legislation, you can actually go to prison if you don't follow the police orders and move on. The other thing is that I think that sleeping in the street may not be good for your mental health.
No, of course not. And the idea about, you know, I mean, people need hope. Yeah, the thing is so – well, I think a lot of people who are living in the street have dropped through out – completely out of normal society. So they are people who are suffering immensely. They have no ability to, you know, get themselves out of that situation. I mean, there's very little help for people. So something has to be done, but the National Party solution is to provide a bill that allows police to go and say, well, you can't – lie here in the street, you have to go elsewhere and lie in the street elsewhere, which seems to me to sum up the kind of National Party approach to most of the problems in our society, whether it's homelessness, whether it's climate change, whether it's inequality or so forth. It's just to ignore the issue and try to squash anyone who points out the problems or who's suffering.
What do you think of the similarity between what the agricultural corporations were suggesting for the environment and put into their advice to the government and the bill that came out?
Well, I think what we've been seeing is that it's no question that we're seeing greater and greater involvement of lobbying, access to ministers, but for people who've got, you know, if you, I remember the National, for example, the National Party had a fundraiser where you could pay, I don't know, some ridiculous amount, absurd amount of money. You could have a seat at the table with Christopher Luxon, and then if you could pay slightly less, you could sit at a table with a minister. So to me, it's bizarre that we're in the situation where that is just regarded as normal, where you can, you know, because it's obviously, I'm not saying it's corruption in the sense that someone's turning up with a bag of cash and going, there you go, Christopher, if you change the law, this money is yours. That doesn't happen in New Zealand, or I don't know about it. Maybe it does, but I don't think it happens, or it doesn't happen very frequently. But it is another type of corruption, not a legal definition, but a broader definition in which the wealthy and powerful gain access through lobbyists, through connections, through networks to the decision makers. And I'm involved in the political process at a kind of not a particularly senior level, but I am involved in it through my work with unions and so forth. And I'm constantly made aware of how the, you know, powerful people in the society have access and get their wishes paid attention to.
It's become more blatant, though, I think, in the last 20 years.
Well, if you have a mindset like these people do, these the National Party people and all their cheerleaders and the media.
I mean, it's probably happened for the last 30 years or so, or 40 years, but in the last 10 or 15 years, it's become really blatant.
Well, I think for a while it kind of probably stopped happening. I mean, it always happens. I mean, there's always influence and there's always power groups and you know, you'd be naive to think it doesn't happen. But what you're saying is right. It's become blatantly obvious that if you've got money, you can. There are methods in which you can achieve your ends, your goals in the political and those decisions that are made affect everyone. It's like, you know, the old American comedian George Carlin, he had a good line for it. He said, it's a big club and you're not in it. And we aren't in it. I mean, that's the reality is. And it is a big club. And the funny thing was, he was a comedian and everyone laughed when he said that. But it's actually one of the truest and unfunniest things I can think of because it's true.
One of the interesting things about society, as they increase their inequality, become sadder societies, more unstable societies. I mean, you don't have to read the spirit level to know that a society where there's more equality and fairness is a happier society, even for the people that are fairly well off. feel more secure and happier.
Yeah, and I think that problem comes when you – it's a logical conclusion of basing your values and priorities of a society on capitalism, because it is essentially an amoral system, because it doesn't really care about where the money came from or where – you know, as long as you can say, you know, and it encourages people, you know, basically the goal is – he with the, you know, most toys wins, you know. That's the only kind of lesson you get from it. All this other talk about hard work and stuff. And, you know, look, if hard work made you a lot of money, there'd be a lot of very rich cleaners, a lot of very rich care workers. There'd be a lot of, you know, they always say if hard work made you wealthy, donkeys would be the wealthiest creatures on the face of the planet. Wealth is about having wealth. And what we're seeing in our society now is a concentration of wealth, intergenerational wealth, which becomes concentrated, and you get a ruling class that is as this gets money because they have money.
And they think they're entitled.
Well, I mean, I think it goes deeper than think. They absolutely believe in a religious sense that they are special. And everyone else is not, and we should actually appreciate them. So I think that we've got a lot of work to do, because I think that all these ideas have become locked into people's minds in our society because of the constant propaganda that we've been getting over years and years, and this is the right way to do things, and, you know, if you don't think this, you're kind of a loser or something. So I think, we've got a lot of work to do. But I think what's happening now is a younger generation of people are really beginning to push back against this kind of rubbish, because it's so patently absurd and wrong what's happening that I think the narrative is the people running the show have lost control of the narrative. Also, and that's why we're in a very interesting time at the moment.
Also, I think that in New Zealand, for the first time in quite a time, not only are working class people and ordinary people suffering and not able to buy a home or get started in owning a home, also the middle class, the semi-professionals, the teachers, the office workers, the...
Yes, it's the... Christopher Luxon is... I don't know if he came up with the term, but we talk about the squeezed middle these days. And no, these problems are hitting people who are actually, and that's...
If you finish university these days, you won't necessarily know if you get a decent job, and you certainly can't expect to buy a home.
And you'll be carrying tens, possibly hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt.
Well, how do you buy a home in those circumstances?
Well, you don't. And that's the very useful thing, is how they've set it up, is that you rent. And you rent... possibly for your entire lives. And you're not renting because you want to rent, but you're renting to a private landlord because you have no choice and you can't afford to get a deposit for your own house. So that is a very good situation if you live in a society which has got a small proportion of people who own a lot of property and make money by renting it out to other people.
One of the problems, I think, for New Zealand is the only way we seem to make money is by... renting houses. I mean, people that have money, they don't invest in starting a business. They don't invest in trying to find a new invention or in adding value to timber or food. They invest in houses.
Yes, and I think...
And they don't pay taxes on it because we don't have a decent capital gains tax.
Well, the interesting thing about it is that what's happening now, what's happened with the housing market, what's happened with the capital gains tax, all these things, they don't even make sense from a capitalist point of view. Like if you were a rational capitalist, or you're looking at, you wanted New Zealand to be a capitalist society, and you were rational about it, you'd say, well, no, we can't, we shouldn't be... you know, building an economy based on housing bubbles when we're sourcing the mortgage money from overseas. You know, that just makes no sense.
Of course, it doesn't make a few other things don't make much sense either. To make generating electricity instead of a public good, it's a private good where people invest in it, and they actually do better if there's a power crisis. And then you've got not only ordinary people that can't afford the power, you've also got businesses like timber mills and so on in the North Island that go broke because they or leave and say, we can't afford to work and have our business in New Zealand because we have to pay too much for power.
Yeah, well, I think that's, once again, that's an example of where the theory that these people imposed on New Zealand has gone wrong. And the power one is a very obvious one. I guess getting back to the alliance, it's something that we are very focused on, where our policy is to, and this might be hard to do right away, but we're definitely it is something that we're focused on achieving, is bringing back power as a public utility. So there's no market-driven things there. It's based on public ownership and it is supplied at cost, so you can afford to invest in, obviously, in maintenance and new generation, for example, in renewable energy. But profit is not involved, whether that's going to the government as a state-owned enterprise or whether it's going to a private operator. It is there to facilitate the functioning of industry and our society. Power. Just like other things like our infrastructure, like our rail, our roads, our ports, they should not be seen as profit-generating enterprises. They should be seen as infrastructure that allows our society and economy to function.
Obviously, the system's broken. Do you think the Alliance can mend it?
At this stage, no, because we're not big enough.
But, you know.
But the goal would be to, this is the thing, is that, is it fixable? At the moment, I don't think, with what's on offer, I don't think it is fixable. But things change. That is the one, we're always told you should be, people should be prepared to change, and change is inevitable. People are always being told that when they get sacked, thrown out of work or whatever. So I'd like to say to the conservative right wing and to the very wealthy people who dominate our society and its decisions, that change is inevitable and change is coming. And that change will result probably in a redistribution of wealth and power in society, so we live in a more democratic, equal, functional society. And I think that is the goal of the Alliance.
Isn't that the debate that we actually need to have and will happen? Are we going to give up on democracy as I actually feel like America's almost given up on democracy and give clear privilege and power to those that already have wealth and power? Or is democracy, are we going to rebuild democracy, post not only political democracy, but economic democracy?
Well, I think it's getting to the kind of a point now where what happens probably in the next, people have always said this, but I think it's like becoming more and more true, that what happens in the next few years is pretty key for the future of the human race, because we've got such massive challenges, would be a nice way of putting it, coming down the line: climate change, inequality, the rise of fascistic kind of movements, fascism around the world, authoritarian governments, AI and stuff like that, which people have, it's going to obviously have a massive impact. All these things are kind of pushing us in to a point of, it's been called polycrisis, there's other words for it which are less polite, but basically it's a situation where we've got a lot of tangled, interconnected problems at the same time as, we've got a lot of advantages, compared to the past. But, yeah, I think, I think a big problem in New Zealand is people have been trained to always go for the don't have a vision, don't have a long-term thing, just go, this is the best we can do. And I think it comes up when we see elections where people get, I just want to change. And they vote for the other side. They're not voting for something. They're just sick of seeing someone on the TV. So I think that people need to get educated, inform themselves, not just believe what they hear on radio shows, for example. But, you know, I think that, we unless we have some better leadership there. And I think the problem is too, people are hanging back. That's what I've noticed for the Alliance. I mean, our membership's growing now. We seem to have hit a kind of chord and struck a chord with people, and things are going well, better than I thought they might be. But still, I think there's thousands of people out there who are appalled by what's happening in society, who agree with our views. If for some reason, they're reluctant to join. I'm not sure. This is not just a problem for us. I'd say it's for all political parties and things. So my message is, don't hang back. If you're worried about the world, this is your last best chance to do something about it, because it's not going to happen by posting a comment on Facebook. You've got to organise, and you've got to come together in political parties. And the Alliance, if you're a socialist or left-leaning person, or a person who believes in our values, join up, because otherwise, you're just handing it over to the people who are doing all the damage.
Is a The way that the threatened fuel supply crisis caused by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz by the Iranian war, is this the way the government's dealing with this? Is this an example of the way they face the future of their...
Well, I think, and this is, I work for the Maritime Union, and we've been going on for a long time about New Zealand's complete lack of resilience and lack of national kind of self-determination, because what's come out of the Iran war is the fact that we are completely dependent on overseas fuel sources. We haven't bothered to move to renewable energy. We allowed our one privately owned fuel refinery to be closed by the petrol companies who owned it. We allowed our New Zealand-flagged coastal oil tankers to be taken off, disappeared. So we're completely dependent on foreign shipping. We're completely dependent on foreign refined fuel supplies. We're a nation that has basically none of its own shipping anymore, yet we're the most remote maritime trading nation in the world. Basically no shipping. So what we've seen, this is how the damage and the corrosive damage that the right-wing global market policies have had on New Zealand. We've allowed ourselves to become a nation that's basically a sitting duck for any crisis. And the fuel crisis, obviously there was, sooner or later, there was going to be a war which affected our fuel supplies. Now, that could have been in Asia, where all the refineries are, or it could have been in the Middle East, where the fuel sources are. And well, we're already seeing the effects of that. People are talking about, we're going to run out of diesel, we're going to run out of petrol. And the cost, of course,
Well, they're rationing it by cost, aren't they?
Yeah, that's it. We do have rationing. It's just like it's rationing by another name, which is you just triple the cost petrol, and then you say, we don't have rationing. Everything's fine. And, of course, half the population are finding it virtually impossible to get to work now. So, yeah, interesting. But I just think that you see, we don't have leaders anymore in New Zealand. What we have are managers.
What are your core values, personally?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they've always been kind of fairly – I haven't changed much over the
years. You're not doing this for your health, are we?
No, it's a bit tiring, but I feel I've got a responsibility to do it. I'm one of the few people in a position where I can do something, so I might as well do it. I just have a strong sense of I don't like to see the wielding of power by people who don't deserve to have that power over other people. And unfortunately, that's what a money-driven capitalist society does. It allows people with money power over people without money. I don't like that. I come from a pretty respectable working class background, people who kind of worked hard and kind of did all the right things. And it was very disillusioning for me. It woke me up politically to see in the 80s and 90s when people like my parents, who were, very responsible people, find themselves out of work or under threat of restructuring. And I just realized actually this system is not set up for, it doesn't matter how well you behave or how nice and good you are, if you are surplus to requirements, you can just be disposed of. So working class people in this country are treated, I won't say what, but they're treated like, often very poorly. That's why we see in things like health and safety incidents, we see workplace deaths. It's kind of just an accepted part of business in this country. There's a bit of kind of like, you know, mealy mouth stuff by the government, but we just accept that, you know. And the current government is trying to wind back health and safety protections. So it shows you what they think of the value of the lives of working people and their families. They put no value on them whatsoever. We are just arms and legs to make money for them. Okay. And that's what we've got to resist against.
Well, thanks a lot, and thanks for coming on board. And,
thank you,
and
Marvin, for putting up with me.
Victor, and discussion of the Alliance, a need for change for more equality.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.